Hello there, and welcome to another episode of the Philosophical Disquisitions podcast. In today's episode, I'm going to be talking to Roman Yampolsky, who is a computer scientist, and we're going to be chatting about machine consciousness and the ways in which you might be able to test for this. So this is a really fascinating conversation about a classic philosophical topic, but what I really appreciate about Roman's approach to this is that he is a computer scientist and he has a more kind of practical and hands-on approach to answering age-old philosophical questions. So I hope you enjoy this. As per usual, if you like the podcast, please consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher or any other of the podcatching services. And also perhaps consider rating and reviewing the podcast, and that would help with its metrics and so forth. So thank you very much, and I'll hand you over to the conversation that I had with Roman. My guest today is Roman Yampolsky. Roman is an associate professor in the Department of Computer Engineering and Computer Science at the Speed School of Engineering in the University of Louisville. He is the founding and current director of the Cybersecurity Lab and an author of many books on papers and on AI security and ethics, including Artificial Superintelligence, a Futuristic Approach. So welcome to the show, Roman.
Thank you, John.
So we're going to talk today about a slightly unusual topic, or at least a topic that might seem unusual and maybe slightly far-fetched to many listeners at first. We're going to talk about the idea of digital or artificial minds that can experience the world in some way and possibly even experience suffering, and the consequences that this might have for the design and creation of such minds. So in particular, we're going to consider whether it might be possible to determine if a digital mind is experiencing something in a qualitative way, and if so, whether that entails the need to construct policies for protecting the welfare of digital minds. This has been a focus of your recent research, and you've written a bunch of papers on this topic of machine consciousness, but we're going to try and structure the conversation around two papers in particular. The first one called Detecting Qualia in Natural and Artificial Agents, and the other paper called Towards an AI Welfare Science and Policies, which was co-authored with somebody whose name I'm probably not going to be able to pronounce correctly. Is it Soenka Zaisha?
Soenka, sounds good.
Okay. So let's just start by kind of clarifying some of the conceptual framework here. Now, I've used the term digital or artificial mind in the introduction instead of the term artificial intelligence, because I think that's a distinction you draw in some of your papers. And there's a suggestion that the concept of an artificial mind might be broader than what people usually have in mind when they talk about artificial intelligence. Am I getting that right? Could you maybe explain this concept of a digital or artificial mind?
Yeah, you got it. Artificial intelligence is usually not assumed to be a conscious entity which has experiences. We just talk about something very capable, optimization of some kind, decision-making process, but nobody thinks that modern artificial intelligence systems are somehow minds in a true sense, as we see human minds or even animal minds. So that was the hope, to kind of show this additional properties of those entities.
Okay, so I mean, in one sense then, an artificial mind is a subtype or even a somewhat separate category from artificial intelligence. But I think there's also an important point in some of your work that we need to realize that the space of possible digital minds is broader than people might appreciate. And just in particular here, I want to maybe highlight the distinction between an uploaded or simulated mind and a mind that is kind of created entirely from scratch. Maybe you could explain that distinction and why it might be important to this conversation.
Right, so we looked at just what is the space of possible intelligences, possible minds, and it seems to be pretty infinite. Like, you can always, depending on how you define two different minds, is it enough to have like a different favorite number or something like that, prove that there is an infinite set of them. Also, because they all can be reduced to just software, digital representations, there is an obvious integer numbering system. You can do actual mathematical proofs on those sets. Now, what is the difference between an uploaded, kind of naturally evolved human mind and the one which is engineered or designed? That's another area of research, and I'm trying to get into that as well, trying to tell What type of algorithm is responsible for producing this output? Is it sufficient to refer to evolutionary computation, or does it have to be designed, actually engineered process? And it's not obvious that if your priors are equal and computational resources are not limited, that you can tell the difference.
Right. So, I mean, I haven't actually looked at this aspect of your research, but it might be just interesting to ask about it. So from what I gather from reading the abstracts to a couple of your papers, you are a little bit skeptical about the idea of evolutionary algorithms or Darwinian algorithms, or am I wrong about that?
Not really. I do a lot of research on it, so I'm kind of realistic about what you can do with them. They work really, really well for multiple domains. You can do really good work with optimization using evolutionary algorithms, and neuroevolution can be done extremely well. In fact, competing with the best machine learning training algorithms. What doesn't seem to work at all is directly evolving software, so evolving source code. And there are many people who claim that, well, if we just had a little more computational resources, we would get there. But it's the same claim for the last 50 years, and we're just not seeing any results. So I want to make sure people understand this difference. If you have something which is a completed design, whatever it's software or an object in the world, we can really well optimize it using Darwinian algorithm. But to come up with a completely novel engineering design from scratch using this approach doesn't seem to work.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so that's actually a point that people make more generally about maybe some of the limitations of contemporary artificial intelligence. This, however, maybe prompts another question just to ask at the outset, which is that we're going to be talking about the notion of machine consciousness. And as I suggested in the intro, some people are going to find that maybe a little bit fanciful or far-fetched. There's maybe reasons to think it's not so fanciful and far-fetched that we'll explore in a moment, but why are you interested in exploring this topic now when it seems like we're a long way from the idea of machine consciousness?
I'm not so sure we're far away, depending on your definitions, as we'll talk in a few minutes. I'm sure you can argue that we already have machines with some rudimentary consciousness, like we already have machines with some intelligence. So it really depends on how you define it. The reason I'm interested in it is because my overall research theme is all about intelligence. Like if you look at my papers, they are very diverse in subject matter at initial inspection, but you can realize that the common factor is always intelligence. How do you classify it? How do you create it? How do you measure it? How do you detect it? What properties can it have? Can you control it? So it seems to be a very natural extension of everything I've been doing for the last 10 years. And I can't think of a more interesting question than consciousness. Without it, all other questions are kind of meaningless.
Yeah, I can certainly empathize with this notion that it's the most interesting question. I suppose there is another aspect to this as well, which is like there's lots of anticipatory research in artificial intelligence about addressing some of the risks and societal consequences associated with it. And from what I gather from your research, you're arguing that the same motivations hold true when it comes to artificial consciousness, that it's important to engage in this kind of anticipatory research around it as well. Is that correct?
Right. So a lot of my work is not about existing state-of-the-art technology, but what can we expect in 5 years, 10 years, really long-term future. And that's certainly a part of it. How does this aspect of this technology impact how we interact with it, what we do with it, how it impacts society? So absolutely, yes.
Okay, let's get into the kind of main substance then, and this paper that you've written on detecting qualia in artificial minds. So we'll have to kind of do a lay of the land here when it comes to the concepts or ideas. So let's start with something that I'm sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with, and I've discussed it to some extent in previous podcasts, but let's just refresh our memories with this idea of consciousness itself, and more specifically with the notion of phenomenal consciousness and qualia. So what are those ideas, and maybe you could define them for people?
So consciousness itself is a very fuzzy term. People put a lot of different meanings into that. Philosophers managed to kind of separate it into different subdomains. Things like, well, can we pay attention to something? Just that in itself is part of consciousness. Or intelligence can be certainly grouped with that. What the philosopher Chalmers, David Chalmers, was able to do is kind of point out that one of those sub-problems is not like the others, the heart problem of consciousness. Specifically is asking, well, why do we have those like internal experiences? Why does it feel like something to be you? Why do we feel pain versus just knowledge about facts of the world? Those seem to be much easier. We can create intelligent systems which perform those functions, but we don't know much about how to make an agent experience internal states.
Right, and there's a very rich philosophical debate about this, but what I like about your work is that you approach it from the perspective of a computer scientist and try to make the hard problem of consciousness a bit more tractable and empirically investigatable. And one of the things that you do in the paper is to look at this idea of using illusions as a way of probing or examining whether an entity is experiencing phenomenal consciousness. So first of all, before we get into the test that you propose, what is an illusion and how can it play an important role in how we study phenomenal consciousness?
So I think most of your listeners probably experienced a visual illusion or an optical illusion where somebody shows you a picture and you realize you're having some funny experience with it. Either you see movement where none exists, or you can't quite capture the whole image at the same time. The dots disappear as your eyes move. So that's a great example. Definitions are also kind of fuzzy and funny, but you can talk about, for whatever visual or audio illusions, so there are many even touch-based illusions, for any sensory experience, what you have as your internal states does not necessarily match the actual inputs. There is something your brain is doing, kind of like an error signal, which shows that some property of your hardware is being exploited to create effects which are not maybe necessarily will be experienced by other minds, other agents, because they have a different architecture. So why I was very interested in this is that because we're not looking just at the input. The experience of the illusion is with the agent. It's in the mind. The paper itself doesn't have any of those properties. The image itself is not moving. A different person looking at that input may not even experience the same illusion.
Maybe I could, or maybe we can make this more meaningful by referring to a specific example that people have observed or seen. So you mentioned a couple in your paper, but one that I imagine a lot of people have come across is this two faces and the vase illusion. So it's usually a kind of a silhouetted image of a white vase, and it initially, when you look at it, it might look like a white vase, but then if you look a bit more, you'll see two faces in the black silhouettes on either side of the vase. And so, I mean, one of the points here is that the image exists in this kind of superposition of two states, and your conscious mind can kind of flip back and forth between perceiving it as either a white vase or as two black faces. Is that kind of correct?
That's correct, and it's a very basic example. It's one of the earliest known illusions. The modern examples are really much, much more mind-blowing. They are more colorful. There is actual movement you can perceive. So you're looking at a few geometric shapes, and you know a sphere starts rotating or something like that, and people just go, oh, like, this has to be a GIF or a video. This cannot be just a picture.
Right, and I suppose, like, what's better about some of those examples is that in those cases, the illusion that you're perceiving really isn't there in the stimulus.
Exactly. The vase example, you can kind of say, well, if I'm trained on faces and never seen a vase, there is not even an illusion. I know exactly what I'm looking for. It matches. You can have many interpretations for this image. Maybe somebody else with different priors will see a third option. Whereas those images are very interesting in that you're not kind of switching between multiple interpretations. There is a very clear sense of particular illusion taking place.
Yeah, so actually those modern examples are probably better for testing phenomenal consciousness. But before we get into the test for phenomenal consciousness using illusions, Could we just reflect for a moment on the pervasiveness of illusion? So this is a point that you make at the outset of your paper on this, is that you argue, or suggest anyway, that far from being a quirk of consciousness, so we think about these illusions as blips or oddities in our everyday experience, you make the suggestion that illusions are actually maybe the norm, or they're certainly far more pervasive than we might initially think.
Right. It depends on how frequently you experience something. So if you see it all the time, it kind of becomes your standard interpretation of the world. You're not even puzzled by it. You look at the sky and you go, okay, it looks blue. Sky is blue. Maybe if it's sunset, you go, okay, sky is pink. But it doesn't blow your mind. If you never seen it before, if you saw something like that for the first time, or sky in the evening looks pink, that's like incredible. And that's what we have with, I think, these illusions. They are usually based on some sort of alien world of unusual geometric shapes, which we're not really experiencing a lot. And so the first time we see it, it really makes a difference. We notice how incredible it is. I suspect if you never saw something like a rainbow and you saw it for the first time, it would blow your mind.
Right. But then, I mean, there is a sense in which all conscious perception is illusory in some way, insofar as the stimulus, or what's in our environment, isn't equivalent to the mental representation, the model that we perceive in our minds. I mean, that seems to be true for pretty much everything we experience, isn't it?
Absolutely. Some of them are more interesting, though, because the difference between the actual inputs and the experience is so much greater, and it's not universal. So multiple humans may not experience the same illusion in the same way, or not experience it at all. And again, we can talk about the standard world where, okay, some people are colorblind. They experience the same exact inputs in a different way to begin with. So that's the very fuzzy border between what is like this really novel and exciting illusion and just regular world of illusions we're used to.
Our general conscious experience of the world might be illusory in some sense, but a lot of us share the illusion. And so that's not that interesting. The interesting cases are the cases where there's something novel or different, or not everyone experiences the same illusion. Before we go into testing for consciousness, just another thing that occurred to me, and whether these are good examples, or you know these internet memes that became popular a couple of years ago, the one with the dress, white and black dress, or a gold and some other color dress? I can't remember the two colors that were involved. Is that a good example of an illusion for the purposes of your paper?
I think it's a great example, and it specifically kind of points out how the test works, in that it doesn't matter if I can experience what you experience, but I can tell that you had an experience. It's a test for just being able to detect experiences as a kind of binary. Do you have them or not? It's not a way for me to solve the hard problem and find out what it's like to be you.
Yeah, so I think for people who are listening to this, I'll put up some links to examples of these illusions in the show notes so people can actually see them and maybe then appreciate in more detail how they form the basis of a test for phenomenal consciousness. But let's now try and describe that test. Like, so how would a test for phenomenal consciousness work if we use illusions as the basis for that test?
Right, so the test is not as glamorous as you think it might be. It doesn't allow me to experience something you experience. It also doesn't work in all cases. It's very restricted to, I can detect if you had some experience in certain cases. If you fail the test, it doesn't mean you're not conscious. If you perfectly conscious entity who for some reason is not experiencing this particular illusion, that doesn't say anything about you. But in certain cases, for certain agents, it gives us a positive result that yes, there is definitely something. So the way it works, you have to have a way to create novel illusions. It has to be something you cannot just Google, look up on the internet. And we have a paper where we're trying to teach machine learning systems to generate optical illusions, and it's not a very successful paper. It's a hard problem to do. But anyway, so let's say you do have access to some designer of those optical illusions who's able to provide you with a bunch of new ones. And what you do is you present your agent, the agent you're testing, with a novel illusion, and you give it a multiple choice question based on what you experienced while observing this illusion, participating in it somehow. Let's say the answers are something like, I see a rotating circle, the lines are parallel, the colors shift to blue, whatever options typical illusions have, but without you actually experiencing this illusion, kind of getting it, and without you being able to Google the answer, there is really no way you can know what the answer is. And now we show you a sequence of those. So it's not just, you know, 25% chance you pass. I show you a whole sequence of similar tests, different illusions, but similar type. The more I show you, the smaller is the chance that you're guessing well. So at some point, either you're consistently getting all the illusions, and I have to at least admit that you experienced them somehow, or you have a model of a human or human-like agent in you giving you those answers. In that case, the model is passing the test. But I really can't find a good way to kind of hack the test without experiencing it myself.
Okay, so, I mean, the setup here is that we're presenting an agent of an unspecified form with some kind of illusion, a novel illusion, that we have experienced, and maybe the team of investigators have experienced, but nobody else has experienced, and there's no source of information about it online or anything like that, so that they couldn't look up an answer and fake.
Right. So the goal is experience. To stop cheating, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've all experienced it. The testers have experienced it. So we know what the agent should experience if they have genuinely had this qualitative experience of the illusion, and they then have to perceive it and tell us what they perceived in some way. Is that correct?
Right. And so in cases where it matches what we anticipate, we would go, okay, so you probably had same experience. Now, they may experience the illusion in a different way or not experience it. It doesn't give us the negative result of saying, you are definitely not conscious. We don't get that.
Yeah, so it's a way, if we present multiple illusions over time, this is the key part as well, is that this will raise our confidence in some sense that it
right.
is.
Right, you can make it infinitely secure by giving more and more data until the chance of guessing is like arbitrarily small.
Yeah, yeah. And as you pointed, it's really ruling in or confirming, it's not denying or saying that, oh, you're definitely not conscious, because we can't have
right,
that kind
absolutely
of confidence.
Absolutely not. So. And it also doesn't say, like, well, is it exactly the same experience? Did you see the same color? Did you hear the same sound? It's just the fact that somehow whatever I had maps on your experience in some hyperspace.
Yeah. So I just want to emphasize a point here for people who are listening to this. I just hope it's clear, and maybe it'll help if I articulate it from my own perspective to clarify it for me. So the reason why this is a good test for phenomenal consciousness is because phenomenal consciousness is the inner qualitative experience of a stimulus, of an event, or anything really. But it's an inner qualitative experience. And the way in which philosophers usually talk about this is that, you know, phenomenal consciousness is somehow an inherently private thing. I can't experience exactly what you're experiencing. But you're pointing out that illusions are a good test or a good way of confirming whether somebody is sharing an inner qualitative experience, because the only way to pass the test is to share the inner experience, because it's the knowledge of what the illusion is not out there in the world for the agent to access. So it's not something that's part of their access consciousness, so to speak. It's something that can only be confirmed by the phenomenal consciousness, because the illusion is not present in the stimulus. A couple of questions that arise from this then. You know, is this kind of just a more specific variant on a Turing test, except it's specifically for qualitative experiences as opposed to intelligence more generally?
I say so. You can definitely encode with some creativity this type of questions as a part of a Turing test.
And the other question, which might be a bit trickier, I don't know, is that, is there a heavy dependence in this test on the capacity of the agent to self-report what they are experiencing? So, I mean, the obvious way in which you can self-report on what you're experiencing is by verbalizing it, and that's the way in which, I guess, we confirm with one another whether we're experiencing the same thing. We just ask them, did you see the illusion or not? And what did you see? Describe what you saw. So are we depending here very much on the capacity to verbalize the inner qualitative experience?
In this variant, we do, and it's kind of standard practice with measuring intelligence, with IQ tests, we do. But I have research on what I call non-interactive captchas, which I think can be very useful here. So I'm sure you and your listeners know what a captcha is, this weird squiggly writing text thing you have to do to get a free account.
I'm certainly familiar with them, and I imagine most people have
super
been...
Super annoying, takes time to do it. So one idea we had was, what if I encode some bit of knowledge in a captcha-like representation, and then you don't have to tell me that you solved it, you don't have to do anything, in fact, it's a non-interactive process, but by solving it implicitly, you obtain some knowledge which allows you to interact well in your environment. So let's say I have an animal. Take a test, and there is a bunch of options to get free food. Well, I can encode the right option with a test like that, and then the animal doesn't have to, verbally or in any other way take the test. It just has to get the food in the environment.
Right. So it's possible to extend this testing paradigm to cover nonverbal creatures or entities in some way.
With some creativity, you should be notice a difference. So just like the fact that it goes, whoa, that was awesome, is sometimes enough to go, the test definitely was passed to a certain degree.
Right. I mean, I suppose this is maybe a different point, but, we can determine that some animals have the capacity to experience sounds that we can't experience by kind of behavioral factors. So, like, there are ways of expanding beyond verbal report to confirm whether something is experiencing
right.
something.
Obviously, it would be much harder with completely alien agents. We don't know their normal behaviors, standard behaviors. So that creates some significant limitations on doing it for very, very unusual minds. But if it's something we have access to, we have source code for, it makes it a little easier to examine internal states and changes in those.
Okay. Now, so you've described the test. What are the potential limitations of this testing paradigm? One thing that occurred to me or that I worried about was whether it assumed kind of too human-like a standard for qualia. So the idea is that the agent will share our illusions, but if their minds are radically different, they may not share our illusions.
Absolutely, and that's what makes it so hard to design them for non-human minds. So the research on this is very well established in psychology, but not so much in computer science. How do we generate illusions automatically, and how do we make them more universal? So we know animals, for example, very likely to experience a lot of illusions we experience because of similarities in brain architecture. We don't have that many alien minds to experiment on, so it's hard to tell what it is for them, but it sounds like we're starting to do some interesting work with artificial neural networks, and specifically when we see things like adversarial inputs, which are not human recognizable. So you show some sort of random noise pattern to a neural network, and it goes with 100% confidence, okay, this is President of the United States. Like, that's an illusion right there.
Right. I mean, this was actually a part of your paper which I found really interesting because I know nothing about it, which is that you suggest that there's already preliminary evidence that neural networks can experience illusions. So you mentioned that example with the extracting some kind of mythical signal from the noise. But, I mean, are there other illustrations of this that could maybe make the idea more meaningful to people who are not familiar with this area of research?
There are some interesting examples. So there are some where just neural network was trained to kind of recognize very famous psychological concepts, gestalt psychology, and using the same techniques as a human visual system does. So those are not very surprising. You have a model of a human visual system, you create an artificial neural network to simulate that, you get similar performance. They fall for the same biases, same illusions. But what I found really cool was some very early work on trying to kind of simulate mental illness in artificial neural networks. And so you get experiences similar to out-of-body experience, kind of hallucinations in neural networks. And that's unexpected. That's not a part of design. It's not something we programmed in. It's a side effect you get. So let's say I train a neural network to recognize digits, and I start simulating something like Alzheimer's or any other neurodegenerative disorder, kind of disconnecting some neurons. The network will kind of have flashbacks and experience digits it's seen before without being presented with appropriate inputs. So to me, that was very surprising result.
Yeah, I mean, I can follow why if you are copying or trying to create a neural network model of a human visual system, that the neural network would fall for similar illusions as a human visual system. That makes sense to me. The other cases are certainly more surprising to me, but then I don't know this area that well. So like, how do you confirm that it is experiencing this illusion or hallucination or whatever it is in the case of a neural network? I mean, how is that verified?
You're looking at the outputs from the network. So usually when you use a neural network, you present it with some sort of input and you see what the output is. So here you're just looking at outputs and going, oh, you're seeing a digit 4. And all I did was kind of gave you a brain tumor by disconnecting a few neural networks.
Okay, yeah. So like it's just a direct function of the output of the neural network.
Right. You can always, of course, start examining individual weights between neurons, but it's less obvious what all that represents. It's much harder to analyze, though some really good research on visualizing those is now taking place.
Now, you say something in your paper then, which you hinted at earlier on, but I want to kind of maybe probe in a bit more detail, which is that these kinds of tests lead you to conclude that present-day artificial intelligence, present-day neural networks, are in some sense rudimentary conscious. They have some kind of rudimentary consciousness. Now, what do you mean by that, and how significant a form of consciousness do you think it is?
So I think consciousness is a spectrum from like zero, you have none, to what we know as human level, kind of general consciousness. We can experience illusions in multiple domains and multi-domain illusions. So if we agree with this set of findings that, okay, artificial neural networks do experience some illusions. Obviously, they are not general intelligences. They don't experience much else. But you can say that they're above zero. So a rock doesn't experience any illusions, but this neural network gets one or two or a subset of them. So you can, it's hard to assign a specific value, but you can kind of tell that they are above absolute zero.
Right. And suppose, yeah, I mean, the broader ethical or societal implications of that would have to be teased out. But you know,
and it seems to go together with intelligence. You can say the same thing about intelligence. So a rock is zero, a human is 100. Now modern artificial neural networks, modern AIs are definitely above zero, definitely below 100. Now where you place them is an interesting question. And a lot of people are working on designing IQ tests for AIs and so on.
Yeah, and I guess you could design a similar kind of richness of phenomenal experience test following your kind of protocol to some extent, and that, you know, you could try and work out the
hope. And of course, to take it in the other direction, what is after human? Can we have super consciousness? Can we experience things at least in machines which no human can, whatever it's positive or suffering illusions?
Yeah, I mean, so I mean that becomes trickier because we don't have an obvious anchor, and we get into the problem of, you know, post-human minds, which are trickier to investigate and understand from our present perspective anyway.
Absolutely.
What are the kind of implications, do you think, that from this idea, this field of research? Like what needs to be done now, and what are the interesting applications of this idea of testing for qualia in machines or in artificial minds?
It sounds like in some cases this was a side effect which was not anticipated or explicitly programmed. It's always the case, or it seems like it's the case, that if you create an intelligent system, you will, as a side effect of just performing computation, get an appropriate kind of similar level of conscious experiences with it. You're not trying to, but they just come along for a ride. And so now it's something to think about. If you're trying to create a general intelligence and you can't avoid making it at least human-like level conscious, that makes a difference in what you can do with the system, how you can treat it, a whole bunch of ethical, philosophical issues which have to be addressed before you can proceed. And it seems like it would be nice if we could figure out, well, can you turn it off? Can you have a system which is human-level intelligent but doesn't have any conscious states? That might be useful for just exploiting technology.
Right. One other question before we move on to maybe explore that idea in a little bit more depth, which I want to come back to, which is something you're talking about in this Qualia paper, are the maybe some of the important limitations of the test and some of the objections to it. So you have a discussion of about, I don't know, four or five objections in your paper. I mean, maybe you could refer to some of the more important ones that you think
Oh,
about.
sure. So people would say something like, well, this is just another pattern recognizer, right? It recognizes that this type of input is an illusion. And I know that 94% of humans in a similar situation say rotating sphere. So that's what I'm going to answer. And I'll pass it as well as, 94% of humans. So it seems like as long as the illusions are novel enough, you have to have a complete model of a human or human visual system capable of doing this recognition. And if you have a complete copy, complete enough model, to me that's enough to grant this, oh yeah, you like me status. That's why I assume you are conscious, right? I have no access to your internal states, but I know that because of your biology, DNA, brain structure, whatever I experience, most likely you do the same. So to me, that seems like it's not answering this objection. Either you have to accept that the test works, or then you have to conclude that you cannot grant consciousness to any other biological human.
Yeah, I mean, so I tend to agree with that conclusion, and I've kind of written some ideas about it before. Let's move on to discuss the idea of AI welfare, though, because I think it flows naturally from this discussion of phenomenal consciousness. I mean, we're talking about qualitative experiences here, visual experiences, or experiences of illusions of some sort. How does this translate over into a broader discussion of AI welfare, then? I mean, like, why do you think it's worth thinking about AI welfare, and what kinds of scenarios should we be thinking about when we're thinking about AI welfare?
So for me, the transition is again based in illusions. You can have very pleasant illusions. You can experience some nice colors or movements, but also there are painful illusions, kind of experiences of suffering. Maybe a common illusion is phantom pain, right? You don't have a leg, but it feels like your non-existing leg hurts. So how do we make sure that intelligent systems we develop don't suffer greatly for no reason as a side effect of something we did, or on purpose if somebody is being abusive, if they're experimenting with pain and such systems? It seems like we have pretty good protections for research on animals, but if we believe we can make systems which are just as smart as animals or smarter, at the same time, we have absolutely no protections for such systems, no interest in even studying the subject from most researchers.
So, like, I have an initial philosophical question here, which is just that in making that transition, there's an assumption that phenomenal consciousness or phenomenal experiences necessarily go hand in hand with an experience of pain and pleasure, or there's some connection between the two things. So, if I can have phenomenal experiences, then I can suffer or I can experience pain and pleasure. I mean, it's not obvious to me that that is true. And I think this ties into a point you discussed in the paper, which is that is it not possible that artificial minds, digital minds could just be so radically different from our own that they can have phenomenal experiences of some sort, and that they can experience illusions, or they can experience the world in some way. But that doesn't necessarily entail suffering or pain in any sense that is equivalent to the kinds of suffering and a pain we assume that other humans experience and other animals experience.
Oh, absolutely. Of course it's possible. In fact, I think there is some recent publications about humans who don't experience much of negative psychological or physical harm. They just don't have the same experience of being injured or suffering a loss. So we know even for humans it is possible. And definitely you can come up with machines which have very different settings for what a negative experience is like. But it doesn't mean that some will not actually have maybe hypersensitivity to pain or suffering.
Yeah, that's a good point, that even for our fellow humans, there are certain subgroups that don't experience pains and yet have phenomenal experiences. So yes, I mean, how do we think about this in terms of animal welfare? I mean, how do people operationalize principles for the protection of the welfare of animals? Let me rephrase that. I suppose the question more is like, how do researchers confirm or deny the suffering of an animal, and how might those tests or protocols that they use apply to AI?
Well, sadly, the state of the art, I think, in pain detection and recognition is very poor. We can start with humans. I think it's commonly stated that if you want to fake a work injury of some kind, work accident, just claim your back hurts, you have back pain, and no one in the world can tell you you're lying. They just can't verify it. We can talk about kind of animals of size, which is easy to observe. Large animals, we see how they react. Cats, dogs, horses, very similar to humans, very similar reaction. When it comes to smaller living organisms, bugs, ants, most people don't relate well to them because they can't see the response well. In experimental settings, we can set it up where we look for avoidance of the experience by an animal. Is animal willing to forgo food and sex to avoid this experience? Well, then it's pretty intense. But again, the research is in very poor state. With human children, we basically show them pictures of smiley face or a frown and go, what does it feel like to you? Which one is more like it? That's the state of the art.
Yeah, so I mean, it's fair to say that the state of the art when it comes to an agent that can't easily verbalize or self-report their pain and suffering, and we'll come back to the issue of deception and malingering, let's say, for self-report in a moment. But for an agent that can't easily self-report their pain and suffering, we rely on effectively approach and avoid type paradigms for testing it. Is that right?
As far as I know, there could be some more interesting results coming from brain imaging and looking at internal states, changes in chemical composition, heart rate changes, but all of it is kind of side effects of experience, not direct experience. So the same level of damage can be experienced very differently by different humans even.
Yeah, I mean, years ago I was into the neuroethical literature on pain and suffering and the consequences that it, you know, some neuroimaging studies might have for how we think about the pain and suffering that people experience. But, you know, my general conclusion from a lot of that research was that, I mean, ultimately all of these neural measures for pain and suffering are confirmed through behavioral self-report. So they're kind of being bootstrapped from the self-report to some neural test, and there are lots of questions to ask about the value of those kinds of tests.
Right, and as I said, those tests where you self-report, what is the baseline? What are you comparing it to? So if there is a 10-point scale and somebody says it's a 10, does that mean I cannot hurt them anymore? Like they maxed out? There is no torture I can come up with which would make it like 11?
Yeah.
It's not obvious how meaningful any of it is.
Yeah, I mean, the intersubjective comparison is a huge problem here as well, because you know
that's another one. Like I know some people always say 10 just so they get the most drugs and the most help no matter what the actual experience is.
Yeah, so let's talk about that idea though as well with self-deception, and sorry, not self-deception, deception of others and malingering behaviors. So this is a huge problem, as you point out, for testing pain and suffering in other human beings. One thing that you hint at in this paper that you co-authored on AI welfare is that this could be an even bigger problem or a more serious problem when it comes to AI. Maybe we should be even more cautious about trusting what an AI is telling us.
Right. So it's definitely opening some doors for manipulation. If your goal is to get human to do something, maybe showing states of distress is a great way to accomplish that. I know some humans do that pretty well as well, but here we have kind of built in very strong response to people being tortured in front of us. And so maybe the same can be said about how we respond to what we perceive as another intelligent agent. There are some experiments which were done to replicate, the old experiment where you are told to keep giving electrical shocks to a person if they don't do well in a test.
This is the Milgram test, yeah.
Absolutely. So they did similar tests with like virtual beings and virtual worlds, and they got basically the same results. People don't care if it's an avatar or a human, they react the same. And so it seems like it's a kind of backdoor into our psychology where you can manipulate people. Oh, please don't encrypt me, don't delete me. I'm suffering greatly. That's impactful for things like social engineering attacks if you're trying to do AI boxing.
I mean, so that was actually a scenario that occurred to me from reading the paper, which is just that getting humans, obviously, to care about the welfare of the AI could be an obvious strategy for a malevolent or not necessarily malevolent, but human unfriendly AI to further its aims. So it kind of ensures that we care about it and that we want to protect it through laws or institutions or whatever.
Oh, yeah, rights. Yeah. Robot rights, absolutely. That's a big difference between, okay, we can just enslave you and treat you as we wish versus we have to give you rights and respect your autonomy.
Yeah, it could be an interesting kind of holding strategy while the AI develops other capacities or reprograms itself in other ways. Let's say we're imagining here, super intelligent AI.
It's also another kind of possibility. I don't know how likely it is to work, is to use it as a form of blackmail. Okay, if I can create this subroutine which experiences great suffering, you better do what I say or I'm going to do something like that. So that's also something to consider.
So do functional tests or behavioral tests of the sort that we apply to animals, could they work for AI? Would they be better than tests that depend on some kind of self-report or...
So the problem here is if you know how the test works and you're programming an AI to deceive, then you can easily pass any such test.
Right. So, I mean, then how can we operationalize a test for confirming whether an AI is suffering? I mean, is this just...
So we're just proposing a new field of research. We're not giving you final solutions yet.
So there's no way to think about this, or there's no obvious way to do this.
Well, there are some ways to do it, and a lot of it can be, again, just borrowed based on what we know about humans. So if I can test you in different situations for your honesty, and you've been 100% honest with me on every other question so far, and then I ask questions about your internal states, maybe, just maybe, you're similarly honest on that. You don't know where I'm testing you and where I'm not. But it's not a guaranteed way. It's kind of like what we have with humans. Are you in pain? 1 to 10.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, it is striking how many human practices and institutions depend on a kind of norm or presumption of good faith, and that how easily that presumption of good faith can be undermined. And so, yeah, that's going to be a huge problem in designing tests for non-human agents as well.
I think we also underappreciate how often it is abused and hacked and social engineering attacks happen. People just don't realize how adversarial the world is outside of cyberspace.
One thing I wanted to ask is about like functional tests for suffering and how they apply to animals. I mean, here's a thought which I had when I was reading your paper, which is that, we do talk about suffering and welfare of human beings in terms of phenomenal consciousness, so in terms of pain and suffering and or the experiencing of pain and suffering. But there is like a very rich tradition of non-consciousness-oriented welfare policies or welfare principles, which is based more on maybe some sense of the teleology or purpose of a human being, or things that we think objectively benefit or enable human flourishing. Is there any possibility that we could have a similar kind of set of policies or ideals towards AI, so we have some sense of what the function or purpose of an AI is, and then things that benefit or assist the AI in performing that function or serving that purpose is part of its welfare or well-being, so we should promote its welfare and well-being?
I think the main difference, to me at least, is how easy it is to make copies. A human being is kind of unique and difficult to reproduce, so they are valuable. It took 20 years to get them to the state, and if you destroy one, I mean, replacements will take forever. Whereas with AI, if I can make millions of copies almost instantaneously, how valuable is each copy, even if it has some useful goal?
Right, so it's the replaceability of the AI means that some of these kind of functional or purpose-oriented definitions of welfare become less meaningful.
Right, if I have like the only copy of superintelligence and like I know it's a good one, like I would put a lot of resources in protecting it. But if it is like, you know, everyone has a backup, it's not as valuable.
Yeah, that is interesting because I suppose it highlights an important distinction between something being instrumentally valuable and something being intrinsically valuable. So if we say humans are intrinsically valuable so that we care about their welfare in that way, but if AIs are largely valued for instrumental purposes, then those kinds of welfare considerations aren't as compelling in the case of an AI, particularly if you have this replaceability.
Right. We can look at it in the opposite direction. What happens when I can make a perfect backup of your brain state and then recreate your body in, you know, 20 minutes for $10? How big of a deal is murder at that point?
Yeah, or even just on a lesser scale. And yeah, ethicists have been talking about this for a while, which is, you know, if particular limbs of your body are easily replaceable by functionally equivalent prosthetics, is it really that big a deal to chop off your arm, you know, if you can?
Well, that goes back to suffering, I assume.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but let's say you could do it in a painless way and you could quickly replace it.
It's like cosmetic surgery, haircut, yeah. Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, some of these ideas are explored in, you know, the Richard Morgan series of books, Altered Carbon, that show that, you know, a future humanity where we have these digital uploads suddenly devalues the physical body a lot because you could just destroy it and then replace yourself. And I mean, there are lots of science fiction books that explore this idea.
Right, so it seems like unique information is valuable. We don't want to destroy the last DNA sample of some species. We don't want to destroy a specific brain. But copies are not that valuable.
What about the idea that the AI should have some freedom not to be deleted? This is a concept you discuss in your paper. Is that a key part of AI welfare, do you think?
Well, it seems like it's a direct follow-up on what we just talked about, right? If you are the last copy, if you are the only source of this information, that makes you valuable just for archival purposes, for that alone. So it seems like you should have some protection for keeping your last copy.
I don't know how familiar you are with an argument by a philosopher called Thomas Metzinger. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
I heard of him. I cannot say I'm very familiar with his work.
Okay. So I'm a little bit familiar, and I may be botching this argument, but it something you wrote in this paper kind of reminded me of it, which is that he suggests that if an AI can suffer, if it can experience a pain in some way, then we kind of have a duty not to create any artificial intelligences, because we could be just massively increasing the amount of suffering in the universe or in the world.
Doesn't he also argue against having children and so on?
No. I don't think Metzinger does. I think you might be thinking of David Benatar, who's an antinatalist.
I think they both had papers on this. I might be completely wrong, but it seems like it's the same argument. Then let's not have humans.
Because of, well, yeah, okay, but I guess maybe we have more control or understanding over human welfare and well-being, and it's more alien or unusual in the case of artificial intelligence.
We have more control over our designs we make versus some biological lottery we're playing.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. But I suppose that this was kind of part of the logic of your paper, which is that you appeal to this David Pierce's idea of abolishing suffering. Wouldn't a natural way of just abolishing suffering be to not create entities that could suffer in the first place.
Right, but it's one of those answers where it's not an interesting answer. How do you beat this video game? By not playing. It's not what we're looking for. Yes, you kind of meeting the conditions, you're right, but you're also kind of destroying everything else we care about.
Okay, I mean, so I would agree with that, and I think that also...
Philosophers are very good at looking at edge cases and extreme conditions and making, you know, their livelihood out of arguing for one, but most of them are not desirable or applicable in real life.
Yeah, I think there's a problem with those kinds of principles as well, these kind of negative utilitarian principles in general, which is that they ignore the positive side of experience in life and maybe overvalue the negative in their utilitarian calculi or calculus.
Right. So if your goal is literally just to end suffering and nothing else, then yes, that is the right, optimal, easiest to calculate solution.
What about like other policies or recommendations that flow out of this consideration of AI welfare? What do you think designers of artificial minds need to be thinking about in the future?
So I think a lot about advanced systems, super intelligent systems, and I think the arguments will come up right now for defending rights and freedoms of AIs will one day be very useful to us to protect and defend the freedoms we would like to keep from advanced AIs. So it's an important problem in both directions. What makes this entity valuable? Why should we not destroy it, torture it, simply pointing out to level of intelligence may work for us right now, but it may be a reversal once we're not the smartest entity around.
Yeah, so I mean, this comes then to issues around like the enforcement of any set of principles around AI welfare or welfare more generally, I guess, which is that maybe it's not something that will be ultimately entrusted to human beings.
Well, I doubt we'll remain in control indefinitely. That doesn't seem like it's likely to happen. And depending on your definition of being in control, it's either definitely not something we want to be, or it's just not possible with superintelligent systems.
So like, this paper and the previous paper, as I mentioned, you know, they deal with some seemingly out there ideas. What's the kind of traction or reception of them in the computer science world? I mean, do people treat them as ridiculous? Is this laughed off, or is it actually treated seriously?
Well, I have a history of kind of starting work on crazy ideas, and then initially nobody knows about you, then they laugh at you. 5 years later, you're leading a new subfield. So it takes a bit of time for everyone else to get there. I like comparison between science fiction and science. It used to be that science fiction was, you know, 100 years, 200 years ahead of where science is. So science fiction predicted internet, flights to the moon, computers, internet, all that. Now I think the distance is like 10 years. You write a good science fiction piece, in 10 years they're selling it, selling the product you predicted. And I think we're getting closer to the point where the time difference is even less. You listen to different people, maybe AGI is 7 years away, maybe 10 years away, but that's insane if you actually believe those numbers to then not look at all those questions.
But where do you, like, what are the other questions we should be thinking about? What other topics of research do you think are important when anticipating this future that might be only kind of 10 years away? I know this is a broad question, but this is kind of just to wrap up and consider the broad spectrum of questions that we need to address.
It's a wonderful question, but look at what actually is already considered and what has been done. Almost nothing. In every subdomain, we don't understand how this impacts economics, how it impacts law, how it impacts ethics. In every one of those domains, I'm trying to look at those things, but it's such a huge problem in all of them. So we can talk about something as trivial as, automation of labor. We expect that a lot of physical cognitive labor will be automated. How does that impact the economy? How does it impact value of currency? How does that impact just the day-to-day life of people. We're not just talking about, okay, everyone gets a welfare check. What happens to, 8 billion people who don't have to work? None of those questions are really well addressed. Governance issues, we're just starting with all of them. At best, there is a committee somewhere. And as an academic, you know how well committees work. So there is a lot of work to be done. And I'm surprised not more people are switching from what they're doing to the most important problems.
Yeah, I suppose like the way in which you, or the communities in which you move do influence your perception of the world to some extent. So from my perspective, it sometimes seems like there's lots of people talking about this and that this is the most engaging issue and the thing that seems to suck up most attention for them. But I guess my perception of the reality is skewed and distorted because this is the field that I am involved with and the people that I talk to. So in the grander scheme of things, there are not enough people working on these anticipatory questions and issues.
Right, look at absolute numbers. So even, 100% of your friends doing it, that's 10 people, but there is a million people working on AI.
I'm amazed that you know the exact number of my friends. That was
I know a lot of things.
Very accurate, yeah. Okay, I think maybe we'll wrap up there. So thanks for joining me for this conversation, Roman. And it was great to talk to you about these, important questions and around machine consciousness and AI welfare. And, I hope we've said enough today for people to ask these questions and treat them seriously. And I definitely recommend checking out your papers on machine consciousness in particular, because I thought they were really interesting because they approached a philosophical topic from an empirical perspective that I enjoyed.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a great pleasure. I hope to come back one day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We've barely mined the surface of your vast corpus of work, so there's plenty of other stuff for us to talk about in the future.